her here today. While she was a doctoral candidate here at Boston College in theology, she was also a graduate research assistant here at the Boise Center. So we like to think of this as a homecoming. I'm not sure we can actually take credit for all that she's done, but we're glad to have her here. Kristen Heyer is now a professor of theology here at Boston College. She returned to BC this year after teaching for 6 years at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles and also at Santa Clara University. She hasn't minded the snow because she's been away from it for 12 years. Her research interests include social ethics, migration ethics, and Catholic social thought. She has several books that she's written, including Conscience and Catholicism, Rights, Responsibilities, and Institutional Responses, Kinship Across Borders, A Christian Ethic for Immigration and Catholics in Politics. And Christians, Catholics in Politics, The Dynamic Tension Between Faith and Power. So please, we're delighted to welcome Kristen Heyer and looking forward to this conversation with her today.
Great. Thanks so much. Thanks, Suzanne, for having me. It is really an honor to be back. It does feel like a homecoming. I can remember first meeting Alan Wolf as a student of David Hollenbach's here, I don't know, 17, 18 years ago, Susie. I don't want to look up the time. but that time working for Alan in the center here was pretty formative. It was such a fruitful complement to my studies in theological ethics. I passed the photo you all have framed here by the door of one of the first Fulbright seminars in 2002, hosting international Muslim scholars from around the world here for 4 weeks, 3 weeks here, 1 week in Fuller. And when I think about some of the Islamophobic rhetoric we hear surrounding our topic for today, I that stands up as a countersign towards some mutual understanding in my memory. And in fact, I was just at a conference this weekend where I cited Rich Mao's prophetic voices lecture from way back when, so the time at Boise has stayed with me.
You'll be here for the conference.
And another plug for the conference for Alan. Great. Well, it's a little difficult to know where to begin talking about this issue of immigration that I'm passionate about in light of this year's election season. So maybe you can call to mind your favorite rhetoric about immigrants during the election season. I think whether we're hearing from candidates about immigrants pouring over the borders or far uglier epithets, what I've reflected on is how out of step those characterizations are with my own encounters with immigrants. So whether with deportees in northern Mexico or folks in the Arizona desert or undocumented college students that I taught in California over the last decade. So there's really a disconnect there, a real dissonance in terms of the rhetoric that I've heard by and large and the actual human encounters I've had in terms of the effects of migration. But I also think that the rhetoric we hear in these debates is reflective of some operative lenses for understanding immigration that have been around a lot longer than this campaign season. So I thought for this afternoon I would just signal several of those operative lenses shaping the debate, kind of what's the dominant script, and then I would maybe make some suggestions about what counter-narrative the Christian tradition can offer. I think Catholic commitments shape a pretty different story than these dominant narratives. And then maybe make some suggestions from my own research and open up the conversation. So I think in terms of the dominant script that we're hearing, three lenses jump out at me. Ones that cast immigrants as lawbreakers, primarily posing a national security threat. Lenses that cast immigrants primarily as economic threats. And then this more amorphous threat to national identity or social cohesion. So maybe I'll just say a little bit about each of those. I think even though we can conjure up Emma Lazarus and her beautiful poem, kind of give me your tired, poor, huddled masses yearning to breathe free, we have this celebratory language sometimes about liberty and hospitality, but more often our debates don't center on hospitality and human rights, right? But these threats and these social costs and burdens. So a law and order lens, to start out, casts immigrants as willful lawbreakers. And we see this conflated with fears of terror increasingly in our day around the globe. I think One concern I have of this is it frames immigrants as threats to the rule of law without evoking any skepticism about the brokenness of our actual laws in terms of legal avenues for pursuing work, for instance, the kind of considerable mismatch we have with our do not enter sign and our help wanted sign at the same time. Visiting Operation Streamline hearings in Tucson, Arizona, I think I often have also been concerned about this law and order or rule of law rhetoric on the one hand, and the lack of transparency and accountability in our actual processes on the other hand. So if you've been in these hearings, you see people, you know, shackled at the wrists and the waists and the ankles, being collectively herded through our legal processes, many not fully understanding what they're agreeing to or what they've done. The ones I've gone to, several sometimes lacking adequate translation. If you have non-Spanish speakers in Arizona, sometimes they don't have native language translators. Maybe they met with an attorney for 10 minutes or so, but I think that evokes for me some tension with trumpeting the rule of law, particularly as we increasingly see migrants from these Northern Triangle countries often escaping not just violence, but violence with impunity, kind of seeking rule of law. I think that problematizes this this first lens. Second, we frequently hear about immigrants posing economic threats, kind of taking away finite jobs. We can also see kind of peaks of anti-immigrant sentiment with periods of economic downturn over history that makes kind of for an easy scapegoat, even in the face of evidence that there's a net benefit, at least to the contemporary economy, of immigrant labor. Immigrant labor, often immigrant taxes without drawing benefits. I think, again, the economic frame of takers versus makers, we heard a couple of years ago more often as well, is problematized increasingly by the for-profit detention industry, right? So we have we've outsourced our detention of immigrants to these multi-billion dollar corporations, not just in the US, but we look at GEO or its colleagues, Corrections Corporations of America is another one. These are a multi-billion dollar business in Australia, in Western Europe, here in the United States. And I think you saw their profits soar when we had the recent surge of Central American miners crossing their kind of real estate portfolios. Their federal portfolios did quite well. So I think looking at how there seemed to be increasingly a perverse economic incentive for detaining and with private buses deporting immigrants problematizes just this economic threat frame alone. And then finally, threat to our national identity. And I think this runs deep, and I think sometimes it gets distorted by nativist tendencies or xenophobia, but it also is rooted in longstanding attempts to define our national community over and against an outsider, right? It's kind of been productive of our national imaginary to have something over against which, a them to define the us over and against. But we have seen with this kind of anti-Hispanic, anti-Islamic hate crimes on the rise, the rhetoric really going south quickly, in my view, reflecting in some cases anxieties, maybe about changing demographics, in some cases nostalgia. The Washington Post recently had a study about supporters of Donald Trump that said the largest numbers are white ethnocentrists who hold negative views on ethnic minorities, but also they are among those who respond that their ancestors are American. Well, that was a really kind of telling conceptualization of the self, right, from somebody in a nation of immigrants, given this young nation's history, we could say. So I think actually each of these three lenses does point to some legitimate concerns. I think, though, they can get distorted and eclipse the whole picture when they kind of are our governing perspective on the question of immigration and the problems of immigration. I better go much faster, Suzanne.
Take some time for introductions. So.
Okay, I'm going to take some time back from the introductions then. I would like to say just a few things about how Christian ethics maybe tells a different story than that. That's, I think, the dominant script. So if fear and profit largely hold sway, dehumanizing immigrants according to these dominant scripts or lenses, I think that the Christian moral narrative tells a pretty different story. Certainly one rooted in a pretty different vision of the person, not a person whose labor we commodify, but a person with fundamental dignity, regardless of what citizenship status they hold, and a person called to be in community, kind of a robust notion of the common good. Certainly we have a lot of biblical injunctions about care for the stranger, and I think compassion for the vulnerable in Jewish and Christian scriptures yields an immigration ethic concerned about justice and concerned about countering the lack of freedom undocumented immigrant space. I don't think that yields a model of charity or pity or largesse, but really a foundation for justice for immigrants. There's so many vectors on which we could talk about the lack of fair treatment, lack of commutative justice in terms of wage theft for day laborers or distributive justice, social justice in terms of our visas. But in particular, I think Christian ethics allows us to talk more than political rhetoric does about deeper root causes of structural injustice, and even look at our complicity, receiving nations' complicity in contributing to the factors that are pushing and pulling migrants across borders. So a notion of restorative justice and understanding the kind of complex web of complicity. I think also, so rooted in that human rights tradition, we have David Hollenbach here, who's kind of the grandfather of this tradition, right, as applied theoretically, but also to refugees. But the sense of the right in the Catholic tradition not to have to migrate, sometimes that's a misconception. People think I will come into town trumpeting open borders and crazy concepts, but the right to be able to make a living in your nation of origin and not have to move. But then when you can't feed yourself or your family, remain safe, the right to freedom of movement in order to do that. And then kind of limitations on the rights to national sovereignty in the face of major rights violations. I think, too, the Christian economic ethic offers a pretty severe counter-narrative to what we see, as I said, in terms of commodified labor, a notion of an economy that serves the person and protects labor rights with or without citizenship status is in grave violation around the planet. But also, I think its notion of the common good guards against this dangerous shadow society that we have when millions within a society are without citizenship status, right? The danger of a two-tiered society, even being proposed now by candidates for political office, one with full rights and one not really with rights, but we're willing to take their labor for jobs that our citizens doesn't want to do, but not let them go to college or vote or go to the DMV. I think a robust notion of the common good also pretty severely challenges that. Even a less robust notion of security, I would say, challenges having this shadow society. Some of my own research has looked also at how the tradition in Christian ethics of social sin might help us understand resistance to this human rights narrative, right, or this call for more just treatment of immigrants. I think that the resistance is embedded in unfair structures, right, policies made by people who set visa caps or extract resources. But also with some of the attitudes I mentioned at the outset with the lenses. So ideologies of xenophobia and nativism at the extreme, but also more subtle consumerist ideologies, I think, that are willing to underpay laborers either directly or indirectly through our demand for low-cost goods and services. Ways in which those ideologies or neocolonial patterns intersect with these unjust structures. So I think some of the Protestant ethicists, Reinhold Niebuhr, talking about sin and insecurity is almost chilling to read today in terms of nations' practices and self-understanding about outsiders, and also some of the Catholic traditions connecting of unjust structures and ideologies can help unmask some of that. So maybe I could just say a word about Pope Francis, if there's a different narrative, to start off the conversation and signal one other interest at the end. I think I can do that in 2.5 minutes. Is that fair? Take three. So what does Pope Francis think about immigrants? He's kind of gotten into trouble. People get nervous, I think, when Pope Francis is on a plane and gives an interview. We can't kind of keep him contained. So I don't actually want to talk about building walls and building bridges and who's un-Christian or Christian, because I think he said on the record, on the ground and on the record, some pretty prophetic things about immigration that sound different than these sound bites at play this election season. First of all, I think Pope Francis more than, Pope Francis in particular, has really drawn attention to what I was just mentioning, this reality of social sin, where he can connect unjust practices to these attitudes that conceal or that lull us into apathy. So he's often talking about a reductive market ethos that certainly gives rise to policies that he says treats migrants as pawns on a chessboard, right? But he also thinks that they have important desensitizing effects, right? So this ethos, I mean, elsewhere, so he's talking about the technocratic paradigm in Laudato Si, maybe that's a familiar analog. I think the mindsets that he raises up, the anesthetization of apathy, right, or the throwaway culture, I think he's concerned to connect our practices and our attitudes with our action and our inaction, and I think that's really helpful. You might recall his first trip outside of Rome was to the island of Lampedusa, which he visited in reading about the deaths of migrants and refugees there, visiting him like a thorn in the heart. And he had this quite, to me at least, quite moving liturgy there. Many things were carved from the shipyard of wrecks that he used in the course of the liturgy, but also his homily was one of repentance. He didn't just kind of blame the world out there, like the world is the problem or the culture is the problem, but he himself repented, forgive us, Lord, for kind of contributing to these deaths. It's not just policymakers making unjust decisions, he said, but it's our indifference. And I think that's a powerful and fertile counter-narrative. You may have read Holy Thursday, I think another performative counter-witness in washing the feet in a liturgy of people from a variety of religions and all refugees, talking about everyone being brothers. But when he came here in the fall to the U.S. Congress, I was curious about if he addressed immigration, what bold metaphor would he use? And he did not talk about social sin. Much to my regret, he did not talk about kinship or subversive hospitality or any of the radical phrases I lifted up. No, I'm just kidding. but I was surprised that you almost might say it was a lower bar than that. He really talked about the golden rule in a sense. You know, he said, do we want any less for our children? If we want security, then let's provide security. If we want life, let's provide life. If we want opportunity, let's provide opportunity. And I think in that characteristic directness and candor, he kind of boiled down this. You don't have to come with me on kinship or subversive hospitality, really, or any radical solidarity to say, is this no less what we expect ourselves? So perhaps I'll leave it at that. Another strand of my research has to do with the feminization of migration and migrant women. But I don't want to take up too much time. So maybe I'll give Pope Francis the last word. Okay.